Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is the first Webtoon Wednesday episode of the new year, and I have a creator with me who's going to talk a little bit about a strip that's coming on Webtoon very soon. We're also going to talk about a couple of other properties of his that you may have heard of. It's my pleasure to welcome Jonathan Mayberry to the show. Jonathan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on here, Jace.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Like I was saying, some works out there that people are going to know by the name, certainly one that's blown it up on Netflix right now. But before we get into all that, I always like to ask people when they come on for the first time, sort of about their secret origin. And since we are the Comic Source, we want to kind of skew that way. I know you've worked on a lot of different mediums, and we'll talk about that as well. So, but I'm curious, background with comics, did you grow up reading them? Did you always have a love for them? When did they enter your life?
Well, I was aware of comics. I was actually reading my brother's comics back in the early 60s. He was 10 years older than me, and he had a stack of EC comics and also a stack of Marvel. But the first comic I bought with my own money, my own allowance money, was Fantastic Four number 66, way back in 1967. So I've been a comic book kid my whole life. I grew up with comics, love comics, you know, and I was originally a Marvel guy, but I branched out.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about that. There's a question that is kind of burning up in my mind here, something to talk about. Just because I was kind of the same way. I grew up always reading comics. They were always around, and I kind of bounced back and forth. Sometimes I'd read more Marvel, sometimes I'd read more DC. But I think generally, if I had to choose one, I'm probably more of a DC guy. So not that you have to like one, you know, more than the other. It's not a competition, but I am curious about ideas that you might have for some characters you haven't worked on yet. So we'll talk about that as we go down the line here. But at what point did you start thinking, and was it that love of story when you were young? When did you start thinking, hey, I want to tell stories for a living? I think that's where talent lies.
Actually, comics are tied up in that. I'm one of those people that always wanted to tell stories. I mean, even before I can read and write, I was telling stories with toys. So when I started reading comics, I just fell in love with the visual type of storytelling. And I thought, wow, I could do this. You know, I wanted to do this. And so I wanted to write comics before I ever wanted to write anything else. Though, you know, the way my career shaped, I wound up coming to comics quite a bit later. But, you know, that was how I envisioned storytelling. And I learned a lot of my core values from comics, too. Wasn't getting a lot of good values from home. It was a kind of a rough, abusive household. So I was getting my values from, you know, Steve Rogers, you know, Captain America, from Reed Richards, from Superman, because I also read some DC stuff. And T'Challa the Black Panther. So comics were fundamental in my development as a person, but also they were fundamental in my development as a storyteller, because I loved the way in which comics could tell any kind of story. And, you know, the unlimited potential of that was enchanting right from the beginning.
And so then you decided to go to school to pursue creative writing?
Well, it's funny, no, because I went to school on a journalism scholarship in high school, which was shortly after the Watergate thing. You know, I decided I wanted to become the intrepid reporter.
Gotcha.
I wanted to break all the big stories and so on. So I went to school for journalism, and probably writing for newspapers is about the only thing I haven't done in the writing world. Halfway through college, I took a class on magazine feature writing. And I started pitching articles to, you know, Black Belt magazine and you know, other magazines, and started selling. So I, you know, I was often writing nonfiction pieces, and I moved from there into writing nonfiction books. I went up teaching at Temple University. I taught martial arts history, jujitsu, women's self-defense, wrote all the textbooks for those courses. And so I really thought I was going to be a nonfiction guy. I didn't actually turn to fiction at all until way later in the early 2000s. I thought, I'll try a novel to see if I like it, because I don't know if I like it. I've never taken a creative writing course. I'm only journalism courses. So I wrote a novel just to see if I would like it. It turns out that's what I do best is novels and fiction, you know, any kind of fiction storytelling.
So I'm curious, when you went down that path and started working on a novel, you know, creating story out of whole cloth rather than, you know, pulling from the real world with the nonfiction stuff, did it harken back to those days of creating stories with your toys and reading comics? And did you realize all of a sudden, or was it a gradual process?
It was kind of a big light bulb going on after, well, let me put it this way. About halfway through writing that novel, I realized, wow, this is really fun. I mean, I get to do anything I want with these characters, go anywhere I want with the story. I'm not bound by what is, you know, something I have to research, something that's provable. I could just build a story. But at the same time, the journalism background and my research I did for a lot of the articles played into my fiction, because I wanted to tell stories, whether they are science fiction, horror, fantasy, whatever, as grounded in real world as possible. And that actually harkens back to the Fantastic Four, because it was a science fiction comic. And there were a lot of elements in there that were, you know, that Lee and Kirby and the other creators drew on from actual science and actual politics and so on. So it was kind of a bit of a full circle for me to realize that writing fantastic stuff, whether it's in prose or comics, was really what my whole life had been aiming toward. It's that my life had trained me for that.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So when I looked at your bibliography, I did notice those nonfiction books, and specifically the ones about martial arts. I thought, oh, that's an interesting way to start out. So what are some of the highlights of your previous works that some of our listeners may be familiar with?
In nonfiction or fiction?
Both.
Well, nonfiction, most of the martial arts books were small press and college textbooks, so they wouldn't know those. I did a bunch of nonfiction books on the folklore of supernatural predators, Vampire Universe, the Cryptopedia, and a few others, because I had a great interest in supernatural legends and myths. My grandmother got me into that. She was kind of like, if you can imagine Luna Lovegood as an old lady, that's pretty much my grandmother. She believed in everything. And so I wrote those books, researched and wrote those books as nonfiction, and then they started inspiring fiction because, like, for example, my first novel, Ghost Road Blues, is a horror novel, but it uses the folkloric versions of vampires and werewolves as opposed to the standard Hollywood version. So my nonfiction research informed the structure of the themes of my first novels. And Ghost Road Blues is how I broke onto the scene. It went up winning a Bram Stoker Award for best first novel and kind of launched me in the direction of fiction. Since then, I've done a bunch of things, like my Joe Ledger series, which began with the book Patient Zero, is my most popular adult series. And there's 11 books in the series now. Rage is the most recent. The Rotten Ruins series, which is a teenage a YA series about growing up 14 years after the zombie apocalypse, which, you know, we'll be discussing in terms of the webtoon, came from my love of both the zombie genre and my research into what would happen if the real world actually had to deal with zombies. I wrote a nonfiction book on that called Zombie CSU. I've written X-Files stuff. I'm all over the place. I'm working on my 37th novel since 2006.
Wow.
So and I've written 120 short stories in that time too. And I've gotten to play not only in worlds that I've created, but also I get to play in other people's worlds. Like I've done, as I said, X-Files, a bunch of X-Files stuff. I've done stuff in the Aliens world, John Carter of Mars, True Blood, Wizard of Oz. I've worked in a bunch of these different worlds, which is absolutely fascinating to do. And at the same time, I'm working on my own stuff, which allows me to create worlds. And sometimes I invite other writers in to write in those worlds, like B-Wars, which is my Netflix show. Each book in that series, I wrote a big framing story, but I invited other writers to come in and write individual stories. So I got to invite my friends in to play in a world that I created, which was absolutely fun.
Yeah, and also Rotten Ruin, which we're going to talk about in a second here, where someone else is actually writing within the world that you created, which I just find really, really fascinating. But before we talk specifically about that, one more question kind of in general. So many times we hear about people they want to be writers, or they are writers, but they're struggling to come up with ideas, writer's mm-hmm. block, that kind of thing. Being that you're so prolific, are there ever times where you struggle, or are you just one of those people that just has so many ideas that it comes pretty naturally?
Well, I'm one of those people that doesn't believe in the concept of writer's block. I actually don't believe it's a thing. So there's always ways of cultivating ideas, finding new things to write about, and developing those. And any new writer who thinks writer's block is a thing, trust me, it's not. It's a label, a broad label we give to a whole bunch of different challenges within writing that are solvable. Just because you don't know the answer doesn't mean that it is going to block you entirely. So I don't get blocked. If I wind up, you know, either losing enthusiasm or not knowing where to go, I look at some of the strategies other writers have used to overcome these things, and I overcome it and move forward. But as far as ideas go, I mean, if you open your eyes and pay attention, the world is full of fascinating ideas. I was fortunate when I was a teenager, when I was actually 12, in that I was introduced to Ray Bradbury and Richard Matheson in person through a librarian who was a secretary for a club they belonged to. And they mentored me for several years and taught me the tricks of how to take anything and turn it into a story and develop that from a concept into an actual plot. And that's served me well, because I can, you know, walk out the door, look at one thing and just start playing the what if game of like, what if this and what if that, and the story will develop out of that.
Yeah. Now, do you work on several projects at once? Does that help when you kind of get stuck on one, you know, trying to figure out the nuts and bolts of how the story moves forward? You can switch to something else, or do you focus on one project at a time?
I do one novel at a time, but I also do other projects at the same time. I usually, you know, because I write comic books as well. I've been writing for Marvel, IDW, and Dark Horse for years. So I alternate with the novel. When I have that on my calendar, I budget in time to work on a comic book, to work on maybe a short story or two during that same time frame. So if I ever need to take a break to refresh my mind, I have another project I can go do. But I don't do two novels at once, because it's such a big universe. Of any given novel is a universe. I need to keep that kind of bubbling in my head. But I can go from there into a short story or comic, and then come back to the novel, and I'm good.
Now, is that because writing a short story or writing a comic kind of exercises different writing muscles, so to speak?
It does, and it's quick. I mean, I can write a comic book script in 2 days. I can write a short story in 2 to 3 days. So it's just like taking a mini vacation from your day job,
right,
and going to do something fun, and then coming back to your day job. So it is a different set of muscles. It's a different process, because writing a short story is not the same as writing a novel, and writing a comic book script is vastly different from both.
Right.
So, you know, you're in a different gear, and you play with different tools, and then it refreshes you. And then you go back and you're ready to rock and roll on your main project.
Yeah, good advice for sure. Well, let's talk about Rotten Ruin, that's being adapted for Netflix, for a Netflix digital strip. Why don't you give our listeners an idea of what Rotten Ruin is about?
Well, Rotten Ruin is actually being adapted for webtoons, not Netflix. My Netflix thing is B-Wars.
Right. Did I say Netflix? I'm sorry. I meant a webtoon digital strip. Obviously, Webtoon Wednesday. So, part of the impetus of
Anyway, so Rotten Ruin, the premise of it is, growing up 14 years after the zombie apocalypse, the dead rose, we lost, and now there's only about 30,000 people left, and as far as they know, in the whole world. It's like little towns, little fenced-in towns in the mountains in California. And the story focuses on a couple of kids who, you know, as they turn 15, they're no longer supported by the town. They have to get a job in order to earn their rations and so on. And the main character, Benny Amore, he doesn't want to do that. He's a typical 15-year-old. I didn't want to get a job when I was 15. And he can't find a job that really suits him. And he winds up having to apprentice with his brother, who he can't stand, who is a zombie hunter. And he hates his brother. There's a lot of animosity there. He has a completely wrong idea about his brother and a pretty skewed view of the world. But by apprenticing and by finding out what the world is really like, not only does his relationship with his brother change, but his relationship and understanding of the world changes. And that's a thing that matters to me. Like, when I was a kid, I grew up in a very racist environment. It wasn't until I saw the realities of racism from other sources that I realized this is how the world really is. I can't go back to being closed-minded or closing my eyes. And Benny Amore is the same way. He can't go back to his old worldview. The world is the world, as you know, as he now sees it. So it's a coming of age, but also a maturing of worldview. And it has some romance in it. It has some good buddy stuff with his friends. And that relationship where, you know, he's having to reassess everything he thought about his brother and about the world. And I wrote it originally as a novella for an adult anthology called The New Dead. And my agent immediately suggested I redo it and expand it as a novel. And now there's 7 novels in the series. The 7th comes out in August. And it's absolutely fascinating and fun for me to write because I love the zombie world and I love the practicality of what do you do if you're in that world? What's the real day-to-day nuts and bolts reality of living in the world where the dead exist as a threat?
Yeah, now at what point when you were thinking about building that world and thinking about it in practical terms, did you decide to, because, you know, there's a lot of great zombie stories, a lot of great zombie worlds, you know, Walking Dead, Robert mm-hmm. Kirkman, and, you know, George Romero's Night of the Living Dead and such, and those kind of franchises. Yours is, Rotten Ruin is a little different in that you are mixing that coming of age and you know, somebody discovering kind of who they are. And whether you're in a post-apocalyptic zombie, you know, wasteland, or world that's fundamentally been changed by that, or you're in our world, going to high school and doing, you know, regular everyday things, you can relate to that. You can relate to the fact that, you know, you're at that age and you're trying to discover who you are and what it means to be an adult and, you know, part of a society. So at what point when you were coming up with the idea that, yeah, I want to explore this from a practical sense, did you decide to marry it with that kind of that overall global theme that we can all relate to?
Well, see, that comes a little bit of the backstory, because when I was 10 years old, October 2nd, 1968, I snuck into the movie theaters to see the world premiere of Night of the Living Dead.
Wow.
The first of what we now consider the zombie genre.
Right.
The first flesh-eating ghoul story. And, you know, on the way home from that, I was thinking about what would I do if that happened. And since then, since that day, I have spent way too much of my life thinking about how I would survive the zombie apocalypse. I think I'm pretty well suited to survive, in fact. And then roll forward to the 40th anniversary of it in 2008. I was asked by a publisher to do a nonfiction book about the zombie apocalypse as part of the 40th anniversary celebration of that movie. So I've always been a practical person. Comes from my journalism background, I guess. So I started interviewing hundreds of people in different fields about how the real world would react, research, and respond if the dead rose. And I had all that research from the military, the police, first responders, the press, the clergy, I mean, everybody. And 250 experts I talked to. And as I was writing that, I kept thinking, well, you know, that's the adult point of view. What would happen to kids? You know, and it's not, the kids here are not growing up in the world as it falls apart. They're growing up in a world that has already died.
Right.
Their world is the world now with the zombies in it. It's their reality. All the parents went through the fall of the old world. So all the parents have PTSD and they lost faith in the survival of their own, you know, their own world. The kids don't have that. You know, like the generation my own son grew up in, the generation of the kids I meet when I go to schools to talk about books, they're not as cynical as we are, as we adults are, because they haven't failed at trying to fix the world. So that sense of optimism and you know, mutual support that teens have, it's so different from the cynical view that so many adults have, that we tried to fix racism, we tried to fix pollution, we tried to fix this, and we couldn't. Whereas the kids like, yeah, well, you know, stop playing with it. We'll fix it. Just leave it to us. And that was kind of where Rotten Ruin came from. And it starts off with two kids, Benny Amore and his buddy, looking for a job. And it allowed me to explore the world of what does it look like if zombies have been part of your world your whole life? What is the day-to-day? What's the economy? What's the, you know, what kind of jobs are out there? And what is your worldview? And that made the Rotten Ruin world explode into a reality that is an extension of Night of the Living Dead to a degree, And in fact, by the way, I became friends with George Romero the last several years of his life, and he loved the Rotten Ruin books. Awesome. He thought they were exactly what would happen 14 years after his story. You know, I'm also friends with Robert Kirkman, who created Walking Dead. The difference between Bob and I is Bob went in a very cynical direction, and I went in a more optimistic and hopeful direction.
Right.
Two different points of view of what might happen after Night of the Living Dead.
So now that you're bringing Rotten Ruin to the digital world, the comic world on Netflix, it's Webtoon, on Webtoon, and someone else is writing it, have you had a chance to see the first couple of episodes? And I should say that when this episode is released, which will be on January 15th, those episodes are out. The first, I think, three episodes drop on the 13th, Monday the 13th of January. So if you're listening to this, the first few episodes of Rotten Ruin are already out on Webtoon. So be sure you go and check it out. But give us your thoughts, Jonathan, on allowing someone else to write this story, and how do you feel that the Webtoon format suits the world of Rotten Ruin?
Well, a couple things. One, the creative team for this is pretty great. Taylor Grant is doing the adaptation. I've known Taylor for a long time. Never worked with him much professionally until this, but I respected, you know, his skill set. And when I got to see how he was adapting it, there's a part of the creator that always wants to say it should be my vision,
right?
But at the same time, you know, he's not doing another novel of it. He's doing a comic book, and yes, it's a comic book format for the phone, but it's a different storytelling format. Therefore, it is impossible for it to be exactly my vision. It's a 500-page book,
right?
You couldn't put all of that into a comic book. And also, you know, having worked in comics myself, I know that there's a lot that goes into the comic storytelling that is not in the words, but in the images. It's visually driven. And they brought in, he brought in this young artist, Alina, and I'm sorry, blanking on her last name, amazing artist from Romania who is doing the artwork. And it is very much, you know, the Asian style of artwork. And I love Korean, Japanese comics and movies. I love them. And it has that kind of vibe to it, which suits the characters, because the main characters are either full Asian or half Asian, in this case Japanese, but still. And it really suits the style. Plus the coloring is lush. It's beautiful. So when I went up to the Webtoon's offices and got to see the first episode and art from the next few, I was blown away, absolutely blown away by it. They captured the most important thematic elements and emotional beats, and told, you know, put that into a comic book format that absolutely catches the heart of what I wanted for it. I actually, you know, wouldn't change a thing of what they did. I think they did a brilliant job of it. So I'm incredibly enthused. I was, of course, surprised, because there's always that, you know, the creator ownership thing, and then they go up there, and I was just blown away.
Yeah, it's so interesting too when you take something that has existed as a prose novel, and I know this, for some people that's what they prefer to read. That's how they. My wife's like that. Mm-hmm. As much as I love comics, I've owned 26,000 physical books. You know, I have this podcast. I've met tons of people, and I just love it. And I feel like I won't rest and stop doing this podcast until every human on this planet is reading comics, because I feel like it's that worthwhile of a medium. But as much as I love my wife, who's named Lois, by the way, yes, Superman is my favorite character. just a coincidence. It's purely coincidence. But she has tried several times to read comics, and she loves to read and she loves stories. But for her, having somebody show her what the characters look like, show her what the world looks like, it just doesn't work for her. She'd rather build those kind of things in her imagination. So with Rotten Ruin, you know, that was you. You built the world, and people were filling it with their own imagination. And now it's coming to Webtoon in a digital strip, and obviously they're going to be presented with these characters, and they're going to have an idea of what the world looks like. And you mentioned the artist. And so they're always going to be their own interpretations, and she's going to bring her own kind of thing to it. But my question for you about the visuals is, how well do you think her the way that Taylor has, you know, laid the story out for her to illustrate, how well do you think they've captured the tone of the world you were trying to go at? Because I got a chance to look at some roughs of the first couple of episodes, and it's got a very distinctive look, especially with the colors.
Yeah.
And right away you get a feeling of, you know, this isn't, you're not in Kansas anymore. You know, it's not this bright, sunshiny world.
No, it's not. There's an interesting overtone of darkness that they capture really well without it being grim, because it's not a grim story. It's a realistic story. It's like growing up in a war zone. I mean, you can still laugh in a war zone, but you're still aware of the fact that there's a war going on. So in the Rotten Ruin webtoon, they Taylor really captured it with the story. He allowed the artist to really tell a lot through images. There are times when there are these long panels you have to scroll down through that show this beautiful transition. So it is a beautiful scene, but you're still aware of the fact that these kids are all living behind fences. They're living in a protected world. They don't have access to the rest of the world. It's beyond, you know, technically beyond their reach. And if they went beyond the fence, they'd probably die. So it has that balance of them finding the beauty in the world they're in, but at the same time seeing the stark realities of a dangerous world. And the creative team really nailed that. I was very impressed because Alina, the artist, is a very young woman, and she brought such a sophistication in visual storytelling to it. I'm just really, really happy that they understood the material so well, and then was able to translate it in a way that I think the webtoon readers will definitely get, because it's visually compelling. You learn a lot from just looking at the panels and looking at the characters. And by the way, one of the fun things is I've seen a lot of fan art from, you know, thousands and thousands of kids who have read the Rotten Ruin books. I've seen a lot of fan art, and they kind of see the characters the same way Alina saw them, which is fantastic. So it a certain type of character is coming across pretty nicely, and she got right in line with that, not copying from the fan art, but interpreting it the way I intended and the way that Taylor intended with his adaptation, so that it's dead on. It's perfect.
Yeah. Again, just the look and feel of it's so unique, that juxtaposition of a young person trying to find their, you know, place in the world. And obviously this is a world much different from ours, but there's something hopeful about that, right? Something hopeful about somebody full of potential. You know, it's that positive aspect of it. And then, like you said, this isn't a grim world, but it's a world with darkness in it. And that juxtaposition is really interesting. I've never read the Rotten Ruin books, but I'm really excited to check out this webtoon for sure.
Yeah, the webtoon's going to be fantastic. I think people are going to love it. And also, it's a sort of thing that's going to start conversations, because just as the novels did, you know, kids start talking about what they would do under the same circumstances, how they would react. And which characters they relate to, because they're, you know, it's not just a single character story. Sometimes their entry point isn't the protagonist. Sometimes it's the supporting character or the older brother. And each of those characters is given a rich identity in the webtoon.
Yeah, we mentioned a couple times your other one of your other big properties, V-Wars. It's on Netflix now, the first season. Obviously, it's on my mind. I keep wanting to say Netflix instead of webtoon. For you, how does the world of Rotten Ruin compare to the world of V-Wars? What are the similarities and what are the differences to you as the creator?
Well, they're both outbreak stories. V-Wars is the beginning of an outbreak. It happens to be vampires, but it's the beginning of an outbreak, and it's a genetic disorder that creates vampires. What we see is the world as we know it crumbling, and it is not as hopeful a story, at least not the first season, because it's about everything that we trust, everything that we rely on, the infrastructure and so on, falling. and also the people that we think we can trust in both government and, you know, sometimes in your own family as they evolve and change, we find that we can no longer trust them. So it's a very paranoid story. Rowan, on the other hand, that's 15 years in the past, that kind of event. And the kids aren't trying to emulate their parents because the parents, you know, lived in a world that failed, that was destroyed. So it's really a story about self-reliance and optimism. And it's funny that a post-apocalyptic story is more optimistic than a story set in modern day. But yeah, that is the difference between the two.
That's true. Yeah, that's really interesting when you think about it in those terms. Well, like I said, it's on Netflix. I think it came out early December, so it's been about a month that it's been out in the world on Netflix. How do you think the first season turned out?
Turned out really well. I mean, again, I was not involved in the adaptation of it. I will probably be involved in the second season if we get a second season pickup, because I'm now an executive producer in the project. But they did a really, really good job with it. And I love what they did. I love the casting. I've become friends with most of the cast, which is fantastic. And they did a really good job. It was different than the book. The book could not be filmed on TV without a staggering budget because right. There's so much going on in the world. Whereas in the TV show, they, you know, they did what adaptation should. They took elements that they can build on that rely on the charisma of the actors and the chemistry between them, and they built a good world. So I'm pretty happy with it. What surprised us all is it blew up. I mean, the night it launched, December 5th, it was the number one trending thing on social media in the United States, number three in the world. And then for 48 hours, it was the number one show in the world, number one watched show in the world.
Wow, and that's amazing.
It's still, you know, number one in China, number one in the UK, number one in Germany. I mean, just keeps hitting all these number one marks. And, you know, we all hoped it would be at least, you know, enjoyable to folks. None of us expected it to blow up that way. And I couldn't be happier. My first TV show became the number one show in the world. Like, holy crap, I did not see that coming.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. When Netflix first approached you to put V-Wars on television, was there any apprehension? And was that apprehension that they wouldn't do a good job adapting it? Or was it that it wouldn't find an audience? Maybe a little bit of both?
I have a lot of faith in Netflix. I'm a big fan of a lot of this stuff on Netflix. So I didn't have any qualms about them adapting it. But it had been shopped around for about 7 years before that, before it was bought by Netflix. And it was actually turned down by a lot of other networks, including a version of it that had a different script that was shopped around, which was a very good script, but it would have been a different show. Mm-hmm. And then it was finally purchased by Netflix, and they took it in a direction that, you know, they wanted to do their version of it. And I was cool with it. You know, it's the Netflix version of that show. And, you know, unlike a lot of writers who get really annoyed when people don't adapt their work, you know, their way, my thought is, and this is advice I got from a couple of friends of mine who have shows, George R. R. Martin, Game of Thrones, and Charlene Harris, who had True Blood, they both told me, you know, with something like this, if people like the show, they'll go and read your books. If people have issues with the show, they'll go and read your books to find out your version of it.
Right.
But in either case, they're going over to read your books.
Yeah.
So it's not like your book disappears when there's a TV show. Your book has a spotlight shone on it when you have a TV show. I'm really good with that.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. And it's the same thing that I tell people that are big fans of comics or a particular character when another writer comes along and might change something that they, you know, in the past, you know, some of the, and how can you not, you know, when a character like Superman or Spider-Man, you know, they've been around for decades and writers have to innovate and they have to change things. And it doesn't invalidate the stories that you read before that you love. Those stories still exist. You can still go back and read them again.
Yeah.
So it's a good way to look at it for sure.
Yeah. I find it fun to read new interpretations. I mean, if Frank Miller hadn't completely rebuilt Batman, you know, we would never have the dark brooding version of Batman that redefined the character for a generation.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, his Dark Knight Returns was substantially different than any other version of it. John Byrne's take on Man of Steel was a completely different version of it. There are some writers who come in and they bring a vision to it that, yeah, it's not the version we're comfortable with, but sometimes comfort isn't necessarily the same thing as having the best possible version or having the only possible version. And yeah. I like the innovation with that.
Yeah, what resonates for you may not resonate for somebody else, but speaking of resonating, do you feel like what you wanted the fans to get out of V-Wars when you were writing it as a novel, the things that were resonating about that story with, or you hoped would with readers, are those the same sorts of things that you think are resonating with fans who are really enjoying the show on Netflix?
Yes and no. I mean, the first season is an origin story. So the origin story goes, you know, has to establish the world and the characters and some of the critical conflicts. But for me, you know, there's a lot more story to tell and it runs a lot deeper. It goes into a lot of social politics, issues of racism and intolerance and so on that are poised for us to explore in the next season. So just because we haven't gotten to it yet doesn't mean that it's not coming and that it won't be, you know, it won't deepen the experience, but what people are seeing of it, especially those who are seeing the show, V-Wars for the first time through the show, is they're getting the essentials of what this world is and the promise of what it can be. And I think that was accomplished very well.
And does it change how you feel about it? And I'm really curious about this because, you know, you mentioned how successful it's been, you know, congratulations again on that. It's number one, it's blowing up across the globe. Does it change how you feel about it as a creator? Like here's, you know, one of your babies, one of your children that you've created and it's now out there in front of more eyes than it's ever been. Does it change how you feel about it?
It doesn't change my view of either the show or the original source material, but it makes you want to go back and play more in that world. Uh-huh. I haven't written a new V-Wars, you know, the last V-Wars book was published in like 2014. And this year I got to write a new V-Wars one-shot comic, but I sure as hell want to go back and play more in that world now because I'm super charged up. And I know there are things that, you know, the world is different now than when we wrote it. I mean, you know, I did V-Wars, I came up with the concept in 2011 and, you know, climate change was just starting to be a national conversation or a global conversation. And climate change is how this whole thing starts.
Right.
So I want to go back and hit some of those notes a little harder, maybe explore the border issues that we have going on there with us, you know, being so harsh to people who are trying to, you know, escape intolerance and live a better life. I want to explore those. So, yeah, there are things I want to do. Not to fix or change what's there, but to build on it.
Yeah, so it sounds like the V-Wars excitement has reinfected the creator himself.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't be happier with what's going on. It's kind of fun, too, because Netflix sent me a V-Wars baseball cap, you know, mm-hmm. when they wrapped production. And, you know, just today, I was at a restaurant having breakfast and writing, and somebody said, oh, yeah, I saw that show. And, you know, I'm like, yeah, you did.
Did you ask them what they thought of it?
Yeah, I did. And you know, they talk about their favorite characters. Interestingly enough, it's rarely the character you think they're going to talk about. You know, the guy today was talking about how much he liked the character of Jimmy Sink, who is a supporting character played by the wonderful actor Michael Gray Eyes from True Detective season 3, and he was also on Fear the Walking Dead a couple of years ago, and He was one of the characters they changed from the books to the show because in the books, he was a middle-aged white guy FBI agent. And in the show, you know, they hired a Native American actor to play. Mm-hmm. And it completely reimagined the character. And I love that they did that. So this guy I was talking to, you know, was Mexican with a lot of, with some Cheyenne blood. So, mm-hmm. you know, here's a guy who has Native American heritage. And he sees a character that's, you know, a really cool character who's in no way a cliche. And he's able to bond with the character and through that bond with the show.
Now, did you clue him in that you wrote it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, selfies were involved.
Awesome.
We had a great time. We were laughing a lot. Most of the staff at that restaurant know who I am and what I do for a living.
Yeah,
so
gotcha.
there was a lot of laughs and, you know, we had a bunch of fun. And it's fun having those moments. You know, I don't do it because I want to get a pat on the back. it's fun because it kind of deepens the experience for someone who's watched the show. Like, here's, you know, I like the show. Hey, wait, here's a guy who created the book the show's based on. Let's all, you know, have a little bit of fun.
Yeah, yeah, no, definitely, definitely. Well, again, congratulations. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but it's definitely on, it's on my list. So I'll have to let you know what
I hope you enjoy.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your other work. You mentioned that you have done some comic work, Dark Horse, IDW, you know, so there's been some V-Wars.
And Marvel.
And yeah, Marvel, of course. Punisher, I think you've worked on Wolverine. You've never worked on any DC properties. And you did mention earlier, you did read some Superman comics when you're growing up. So it's not, you know, a lack of knowledge or you've never read DC, you don't like DC. But are there characters that you still have comic stories that you would like to get your hands on and tell? And specifically, if there's any DC characters, I'd be very curious to know who they might be.
Yeah, well, real quick backstory on the DC thing. I started off as a Marvel kid, but I got into DC because of Jack Kirby going over to DC and the Fourth World thing. I absolutely huge fan of that. I read all the books related to that, New Gods and Mr. Miracle and so on. And then I got into the Neil Adams, Denny O'Neill, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. And I became quite a DC fan over the years. Now, as far as not working for them, that may change, but best I can say right now is no comment at this time. But there is a substantial possibility that may change. Big fan of DC, love the DC TV series that they have out. I actually like the series more than I like the movie. I mean, the movies are good, but I love the DC TV series. I think they are truer to the comics in that they bring in the supporting characters and the shows overlap. So there are characters I would like to work on. I always want to do a Clark Kent story, especially one about Superboy, the older Superboy just before he became Superman. Kind of the same era as Smallville, but not a small. I don't want to write a Smallville story. I want to write a young Clark Kent story with a couple of different elements of my own type of storytelling in there. You know, bioweapons and body horror, ecoterrorism, and so on. I would love, you know, everybody in the world wants to do a Batman story, but I also like the character of Deadman. I would love to explore that character. Would love to do Doom Patrol. I mean, there's a bunch of DC stuff I'd love to do. Maybe a little bit of Green Arrow because he's another one of those emotionally compromised and therefore complex characters. I'd love to play in that world. So if the opportunity actually does gel for me to write in DC, and there is some possibility there, I am going to have a blast because I do know those characters and I love those characters.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me to hear you say Clark Kent when you start talking about it, knowing that you started your career, you know, as a journalist or as a journalism major. Yeah. So that kind of makes sense. And yeah, Deadman, again, you know, right in your wheelhouse, would love to see you take on Boston Brand. And, you know, you might take him in a little scarier direction than we've seen in quite a few years, which would be a lot of fun.
There is always the possibility that if I write something for comics, it's going to have a horror element to it. You know, the comic I'm writing right now, Pandemica for IDW, is bioterrorism, but it's a horror comic in that it's actually doable. The quick conceit there in Pandemica, they're using the CRISPR gene editing technology to create ethnic-specific bioweapons for ethnic cleansing.
Wow.
And releasing them here in the United States. And when I come up with the idea originally, it was, you know, all right, this is far-fetched science fiction. And then I start talking to molecular biologists who are like, not so much science fiction as we're afraid of that happening like now. So it's become a very much a cautionary sort of tale. And that's what happens sometimes with writers. You write something that you're afraid of ever happening in the future, and then you find out you might be closer to it now. So you want your comic to be maybe a bit of a cautionary tale.
Yeah, it's, I don't know if you know Matt Hawkins over at Top Cow, but a lot of his stuff is rooted in real science think tank and such. There's scary stuff in there too. I think one of the arcs of Think Tank was about something similar. It was about being able to build a virus that would kill a specific family. and, you know, be harmless to anybody else. And it's all based on real stuff. So yeah, definitely scary when you think about it.
Our science has caught up to what mad scientists used to be in the old stories. And it's caught up to things like the Nazi master race program and so on, eugenics idea. Well, you know, we can actually do that now. And that's absolutely terrifying. So yeah, I want to write about that because I want to have conversations about that. I want to start conversations about that. And you know, we write what scares us. I'm not afraid of a junkie coming at me with a switchblade, but a bioweapon in the hands of somebody who could do real harm to people. Yeah, that's terrifying.
Yeah, it definitely is. And taking on these scary subjects, you mentioned earlier, when you do it in the medium of comics is a lot of fun for you, right? Like when you take a break from writing whatever particular novel you're working on for a few days to write a comic strip, you mentioned how that process is so much fun for you. Can you kind of explain what you enjoy so much about the comics medium?
Well, actually, first, let me quickly tell you how I got into comics because that plays into this. I had been trying to figure out how to write for comics for a while, and my agent and I were trying to strategize. And then Axel Alonso, who used to be editor-in-chief of Marvel, called me out of the blue. He had read my novel Patient Zero and said, hey, you know, I really dig the way you write action and dialogue and so on. Any chance you might ever want to consider writing for Marvel Comics? It's one of those questions that you kind of feel like you should just burst out laughing. So I went up writing for him for a number of years, including being the regular writer on Black Panther. When the T'Challa was injured and Shuri had to step up to be the Panther, I actually wrote the first run of comics with Shuri at the start of the book, and which was a lot of fun. So writing these characters, writing these types of stories allows me to explore ideas that make it a lot of fun to tell a story. Like you can tell a grim story, but you can have fun doing it by, you know, and fun is a relative term, by the way. I mean, fun for a writer of this sort of stuff isn't, you know, happy, fuzzy bunny fun. It's, oh my God, this story is going to scare the pants off of somebody, or it's going to open some eyes. It's going to start a conversation. And I get to play with these characters. How cool is my life right now that I'm sitting here writing a Captain America comic or writing a Punisher comic? How cool is that? You know, it's surreal as hell. So there is that fun part, even if the subject matter of the comic itself is something grim. You're still having fun in your job because your job is being able to tell these types of stories to an audience who loves these types of stories. And not just love these types of stories, but stories told in this fashion. So fun is a weird word, but it is accurate.
Well, it's also the fact that, like you said, it's not only that you're writing these stories about, you know, some characters that you grew up reading, you know, the comic stories of and falling in love with, but also the universe itself. You know, you're contributing to the Marvel universe. And I imagine when you're excited about it, it makes the writing process that much easier. It kind of flows, you know, just like you said with V-Wars, you know, how you're re-energizing, you can't wait to get back at it. That's probably going to be a lot of fun for you. Even though you wouldn't necessarily consider the world of V-Wars a fun place to inhabit.
No, it's not a happy-go-lucky place. But you know, getting involved in this sort of stuff is, like I said, fun is a relative thing, and it's kind of hard to quantify exactly what fun is. But I love working with characters that I have loved my whole life, and who have been, you know, essentially are inviting me to tell fresh stories about them, or to use them to tell stories that, or to talk about issues that matter to me. Like for example, with Black Panther, there are elements of my run on Black Panther that influenced the entire, you know, what happened in the Marvel Universe. At the end of my run of this one arc, Doom War, I destroyed all of the Savage, all of the Wakandan vibranium in the Marvel Universe. It's gone. So a little while after that, in the Spider-Man comic, Peter Parker is trying to create synthetic vibranium because, you know, the Wakandan vibranium is gone. And elements of my story were picked up with Ta-Nehisi Coates when he took over the book. There were elements of my story, including characters I created, that he took and began using, because they're now part of that world. They're now part of the Marvel Universe forever. There's even a possibility, there's rumors out there, that my Doom War storyline may influence the next Black Panther movie.
Wow, which, that's cool.
If it happens, I may actually think. But now, you never know.
You did also mention earlier that if there's a second season of V-Wars, you may be more involved as an executive producer. Will you be contributing anything in the writer's room or anything story-wise?
No, no, yeah. That's a decision Netflix would make, and Netflix hasn't yet, you know, authorized the next season. But I know that the star, Ian Somerhalder, would like me to be involved in the storytelling. He and I have had quite a few conversations about what would be in that second season, and what would be the interesting directions to go in. He and I share very similar views in terms of politics, in terms of social justice, and also, you know, hot button issues that we feel can be explored in interesting ways in the show. So, you know, he wants to be involved in both plotting and possibly writing. And if that happens, it'll be the first time I've actually written for television.
Yeah, so, I was gonna ask if that was the case. I didn't think you'd written any TV stuff before. So that, again, that'll be a different experience, just like, you know, comics is different from short stories is different from
sure. Yeah, and one of the advantages of being executive producer is, you know, going forward is I'll be able to actually have some say and at least advise on how to take the story and run with it, go deeper with it. And that's also true with Rotten Ruin, not the comic version as much, the webtoon version as much, but it's been also optioned for film by Alcon Entertainment, the people who do the Expanse TV show and Blade Runner 2049, Book of Eli. They've optioned it for film, and I'll be executive producer if they actually go and make a film out of it. So I'll have some creative input there as well.
Yeah, well, that'll be cool. I hope that that comes to pass. I'm curious. So many times when I have artists on, we talk about the fact that they don't want to ever stagnate. They always want to keep, you know, redefining their style and challenging themselves and growing as an artist. You're such a prolific writer. Is it the same with writing? Are you constantly finding ways to challenge yourself and make sure that you're not, I don't know, you're not,
well, telling yourself? I don't feel I'm in danger of stagnation. I always want to try something new, though. I love a challenge. I started off writing horror, switched to thrillers, did some science fiction books, did media tie-in, done a bunch of things. Just today, in fact, I had a conversation with my editor at one of the publishing houses about the possibility of my writing some epic fantasy. I used to love the old Conan and Elric of Melbourne and other fantasy books. And, you know, he's asking, you know, he called me out of the blue and said, "Hey, do you have any interest in writing epic fantasy?" I'm like, "Why, yes, I do." Because that's something I haven't done and would love to do. You might be too young to remember this, but there was an old commercial series for Life cereal where there was a kid who they said, you know, let Mikey try it. He'll eat anything.
Yep.
Well, I'm kind of that way with writing. I'll try anything if I think it's going to be fun and if I think I can bring game to it. I won't do something if I don't think I'm going to have fun and if I don't think I'll bring game. But if it looks like it's going to be a hoot, then I'm in. And sometimes I have to talk my agent into some of the things I want to experiment with, but that's okay. You know, we had a conversation about it today, and I convinced her that writing epic fantasy might be, in fact, just the thing for the next phase of my novel career. And I'll have a blast doing it because I love doing new stuff, but I don't feel I'm going to stagnate. There's too many ways in which you can tell good stories, and there's always a possibility for a writer to continue learning more about his craft, so that we shouldn't be the same writer today we were yesterday. And that means that you can't stagnate if you are actually moving forward.
Well, and it harkens back to something you said earlier, right? You walk out the door and you experience the world, and you should be getting ideas for stories. And so as long as you keep living your life and gaining new experiences, then obviously your stories should reflect that.
Yeah, and it's living a life with your eyes open. Pay attention and ask yourself questions all the time. Writers, we're not in the business of giving a bunch of characters a happy day. So we tend to think of, what's the worst that could happen? And it could be anything. Literally, you could be sitting there on a beach chair looking at birds in the trees and start thinking, well, what's the worst that can happen? And if you have a writer's mind, you're going to come up with 20 different ideas of what's the worst that can happen in that moment. Everything from a tsunami to the bird crapping in your mouth. I mean, every range of technique of possibility comes there because you're used to saying, well, if this is the setup, what's the crisis? And the crisis is where we find the human drama, because a crisis impacts the lives of the characters, and there's no limit, no end to the possible variations of human drama if you keep the characters as the centerpiece of your fiction and not just write the events.
So that's good advice for you aspiring writers out there. Well, thank you so much, Jonathan, for taking the time to talk to me. It's been a real pleasure. As we're winding down here, I want to give you the chance. Anything you want to say to your fans, whether they're fans of your comics or the V-Wars TV show, or looking forward to the upcoming Rotten Ruin, the floor is yours, so to speak.
Well, my fans have had to buckle up because I've made a lot of twists and turns and been through houses of horror and so on with my career. I'm always throwing new stuff at them. So I know you guys will love, in fact, the Rotten Ruin webtoon. I know you're going to love it because I love it, and we're all book and pop culture geeks together. So I'm really sure you're going to dig this because it's well done by people who get it. And that makes them part of our tribe of pop culture nerds who love a good story. So yeah, check out the webtoon thing. And for those who aren't as familiar with my work, come and find out. If just spell my last name right, and you'll find me. It's Mabery, Jonathan Mabery. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. I've got a website. Come on and find me. We're going to have some fun. It's going to be a little weird, but we're going to have some fun. And even I don't know what always is coming next. So, come join come and have some fun in the playground with us, because it's going to be weird toys and we're going to have a bunch of fun.
Yeah. And are you active at all in social media? If someone wants to follow along with your work, is there a particular place that's better than another?
Yeah, I'm on social media. It's funny, 10 minutes out of every hour of my business day, I'm on social media. I love social media. I've got Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. I'm pretty sure I have a Pinterest page, Snapchat. If it's social media, I'm there. So like I said, come and find me.
Awesome. I'll put links to Jonathan's Twitter and Instagram in the show notes, everybody. So if you want to follow him, you can go and click there and find it. So again, Jonathan, it's been a lot of fun talking. Thanks for joining me, and love to have you back on anytime to talk comics, especially if you get a chance to tell some of those DC stories you were talking about.
Yeah, well, Jace, first of all, this has been a lot of fun, but if this DC thing happens that we're in discussions about, I definitely want to come on and talk to you about it.
That'd be great.
Because I think you'll dig what I'm doing with it. So, yeah, let's keep in touch.
All right. Sounds good, Jonathan. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks, sir.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.